has the disclosure of the Burevestnik missile, the new nuclear-armed, nuclear-powered missile by the Russian side that they have unveiled, is that going to change the course of the war? Is that going to change the mentality and the thought process and the decision-making of both the American, the Ukrainian, the European, and maybe even the Russian mentality in terms of whether this war is going to continue on being fought or whether they're finally going to reach a negotiated settlement? It's more complicated than it may appear, but it is also more concerning than it appears. And we're going to try and break all this down. We have with us back after a bit of a hiatus. I'm very grateful to have Alexander Mercurius back with us, the co-host of the Duran YouTube channel at Alex Mercurius. And we are very grateful to see you back. Well, welcome back.
Thank you very much. And I'm delighted to be here again, I must say.
Always a pleasure. I'm always eager to get your take on a lot of these things here. And I just want to start off with this Burevestnik, because I think that is certainly, you hesitate to use the term game changer, but even the mentality, because it's not literally new, it's just newly tested. But the fact that it is now presented I guess it's part of the fabric of all the things that are going on talking here. It does have the feel that has changed the conversation. Maybe that's a better way to put it. And I want to play something from Vladimir Putin earlier today when he was talking to some wounded soldiers, where he highlighted some of the utility and some of the advanced capabilities of this missile.
You've probably heard that a new, cutting-edge missile with an unlimited range and a nuclear propulsion system was tested just recently. It has undeniable advantages. The advantage is that it's a small nuclear propulsion system. The most important thing is that while a conventional nuclear reactor starts up in hours, days, or weeks, this nuclear reactor starts up in minutes and seconds. This is a truly enormous achievement.
So, according to this Burevestnik, it is a cruise missile, not too much different than even the U.S. Tomahawk cruise missile, except that it has a nuclear propulsion, which basically means it has unlimited range, and it can fly from literally anywhere, it can maneuver, it can do all kinds of things, and its claim is that it makes it nearly impossible to intercept. But let me just ask what you actually think about this, because in terms of the overall nuclear deterrence, I mean, there was already nuclear parity. There's already, from the normal ICBMs that the Russians had or their tactical nuclear weapons, their nuclear triad. I mean, there was already so that didn't add anything to the deterrent value, but it has added something, I guess, to the technological. What do you make of this missile?
Well, if what we've been told about it is true, and I have no reason to doubt that it is true, then this is indeed a major technological advance. I am not an engineer or a technical person, but I understand that the Russians' success in apparently miniaturizing a nuclear reactor is remarkable. And apparently in Norway, they monitored this test and they found no radioactive contamination as a result of it, which suggests that whatever this nuclear reactor, however it works, and I don't know anybody who's explained how it works, it seems to work on some kind of closed cycle system. So technologically, this is a breakthrough. As a weapon, well, I'm going to say it, I find it very, very frightening and extremely destabilizing, because as you rightly say, we already have nuclear strategic parity, but now we have a missile that seems to be almost designed to be as destabilizing as possible. It can fly towards the United States from any direction. It is apparently very difficult to track. It is apparently a system that can loiter, so it can presumably operate over the seas and oceans or the Arctic Ocean or wherever, are undetected or perhaps even unsuspected for lengthy periods of time. I can imagine that in a time of tension, if these weapons become deployed, if the United States becomes aware that the Russians are launching these things and that they're loitering around in, you know, wherever, I can imagine how, well, the effect of that is going to have on intensifying tensions. I mean, it's going to raise them, I would have thought, to stratospheric levels. And this latest other system that the Russians have now deployed, the Poseidon nuclear-powered submarine drone, I would say that that is equally alarming system. Now, the Russians are doing this because they sense that they've long sensed that they are in a position of geographical disadvantage relative to the United States, because the United States is able to operate cruise missiles and such missiles close to Russia, base them on land in Europe and that kind of thing. So it makes a kind of strategic sense for the Russians to develop them. And the Russians have also talked about how these would be second strike weapons if the United States were able to launch an attack on Russia. Then these weapons would be capable of countering, of striking the United States after a second strike. But to my mind, the fact that these weapons have been developed and are apparently going to be deployed now is testament of the very dangerous situation we are in with the collapse of arms control. The New START treaty is due to expire in February. There are no negotiations between the United States and Russia about nuclear weapons. The entire structure of arms control and arms limitation, which I think both of us grew up with during the Cold War, has effectively collapsed. And we can see that these weapons, these very dangerous and very destabilizing weapons, are now starting to appear. I think the United States should urgently seek to discuss these weapons with Russia and should urgently agree with the Russians a one-year extension of the START Treaty, which the Russians, by the way, have offered, and that we should see about how we can bring this whole business of arms control and nuclear weapons back under control again, so that we avoid the disaster that we seem to be sliding towards.
Yeah, we actually had Russian Ambassador Polyansky on the show, who made that exact statement on our show, that yes, they want to get back into arms reduction treaties. They want to have an extension of the START so that they can then have all the relevant experts then spend the following, or that subsequent year, to actually come up with a new system that would then go on indefinitely. And we're certainly huge supporters of that. I mean, why anybody on the planet Earth would not be is beyond me, but we'd like to get to it. For those, though, who may not know, a lot of people have been talking about the Burevestnik missile, because that's been kind of in the news a lot the last couple of days. But some may not know what the Poseidon is. Let me show for our viewers here something that Putin also said earlier today about the Poseidon.
You've probably heard that a new, cutting-edge missile with an unlimited range and a nuclear propulsion system was tested just recently. It has undeniable advantages. The advantage is that it's a small nuclear propulsion system. The most important thing is that while a conventional nuclear reactor starts up
Gary,
in hours,
I think that's the one we
days,
played already. We're
weeks,
looking for the other one, the one on the
This nuclear reactor starts up in minutes and seconds. This is a truly enormous achievement.
Just yesterday, there was another test of a future weapons system, and that's an unmanned submarine, Poseidon, with a nuclear power plant. There are no rivals to it, and there are no ways of intercepting it.
And for those who may not know, so that's, again, apparently used the same baseline technology of a nuclear propulsion as well. And what the Poseidon does is it's this... and it's an unmanned, it's kind of like a submarine or a torpedo, a huge one, that has a nuclear weapon on board. It will then fly near a coastal area like you're seeing depicted here on New York. It will explode and detonate under the sea, and then it will create a tidal wave that will then swamp the area, covering it with nuclear fallout and all kinds of things, making it uninhabitable. It's just a really terrifying weapon, because there's literally no way that you can see it. At least with missiles, you can track them coming in. With these submarines here, you can't tell where they're at. you don't even know anything's coming in there. So it is one of the more frightening technologies that we've seen. As far as I know, we don't have any, but it's combined with the Burevestnik, this is a real troublesome.
Absolutely. And I think what the reason the Russians are moving towards developing these systems is because of what we discussed previously, the fact that the system of arms control has broken down. The Russians have always been extremely sensitive, understandably, about American plans to deploy medium-range missiles that can reach Russia, Moscow itself, in Europe. They were unhappy about that in the early 1960s when it was done with the Jupiter missiles at that time. And that was one of the factors, by the way, that led up eventually to the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy wisely decided to withdraw those missiles. Then the United States and the European countries moved forward in the 1970s and 1980s to deploy nuclear-equipped Tomahawk missiles and Pershing II missiles in Europe in the 1980s. That also created a major crisis at the time. Again, President Reagan very wisely negotiated the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty with the Soviets at that time, and that whole class of weapons was eliminated. Now we've pulled out of the INF Treaty. There are rumors and talk about us deploying weapons, similar weapons, to Europe again. The Russians are again extremely alarmed about this. And I think they see these weapons that they've developed now, the Poseidon and the Burevestnik, as counters to future American developments of medium-range missiles in Europe, particularly hypersonic missiles, which have been talked about. So what we need to do is to get into a negotiation with the Russians and trade these missiles off. Do what Presidents Kennedy and Reagan did in the past. Yes. And it seems to me obvious.
Well, it would appear that way. That's, if people were thinking rationally and logically, that probably would already have happened. The fact that it hasn't is itself alarming because it shows that we're not thinking rationally. And then when you overlay that on top of what we're doing with the war itself between Russia and Ukraine, I mean, it can't help but add another layer of concern. And let's take a look at that, though, because this, you can't take view one without the other, because these things are all inextricably interwoven. And with the United States especially. Okay, so I think since the last time you and I talked, the plan was, you know, Russia and the United States with Trump wanted to get together and have this conversation with Putin. They said, hey, how's about we have our foreign ministers meet together, and then we'll get together in Istanbul, I'm sorry, in Hungary and in Budapest, and then we'll bring the thing to an end. And then that didn't even last but a few days and started falling apart almost right away. And now then all of it's on hiatus. No one's talking about it. And so apparently Trump, feeling frustrated, said, all right, tell you what, I'm going to now put some huge new sanctions on there. So he had two of the Russia's biggest oil companies put sanctions on there, et cetera. A lot of the claims are that both India and China will abide by some of them. I'll believe it when I see it, but that's some of the early reports. But the question is that going to be putting pressure on Russia to finally bring them to their knees? Now, according to U.S. NATO Ambassador Whitaker, he seems to think yes.
The president's point is very clear, is that we expect now, with these enormous sanctions that have been placed on Lukoil and Rosneft, that this will maybe be the thing to unlock President Putin coming to the table and ending this war and at least entering into a ceasefire so we can, you know, negotiate a final resolution. But remember, as I've said before, President Trump holds all the cards. This is just one card that he's playing. There are many more.
Okay, a lot of trouble with that statement right there. We're going to take it in two parts. First of all, let's take a look at the first thing that he says there, is that these sanctions will finally bring Russia to the table. Now, as I think you and I've discussed, probably every time we've ever talked about negotiated settlement, Russia's never left the table. They're still at the table. But when Whitaker says that, and when all of the Europeans say that, and definitely Ukraine, what they mean is that comes to the table and then is going to give Ukraine what it wants and Europe what it wants, which Russia's, I don't think, going to do. How do you see it?
No, of course, absolutely. I mean, can I just say, I mean, not only were the Russians always at the table, but I mean, it's a strange thing to say something like that when it's the United States that has cancelled a meeting between its president and the Russian president, between Putin and Trump. But anyway, put that aside. I've heard this narrative about, you know, we'll impose more sanctions on the Russians and we're going to get the Russians to capitulate, because that's exactly what it means. I mean, come along to the table and give Ukraine everything that it wants, or at least, if not what it wants, a freeze of the conflict, which will keep everything frozen so that Ukraine presumably can rearm in the future. That's what the Russians fear. And the war can resume again in some other form in 4, 5, 8 years, 10 years' time, whatever. What the Russians anyway have always rejected. The Russians are not going to agree to this. And they have not agreed to this after every previous round of sanctions. Why Mr. Whitaker and other people in the United States believe that these additional sanctions are going to change the Russian calculus, I simply do not understand. I mean, even if they were to have some impact on the Russian economy, which perhaps they might, is it really going to be enough to make the Russians change their policies? I mean, I don't know of any war that has been successfully brought to a stop in that way. The way you end wars is through negotiations with the other side, in which you address their concerns, not by putting sanctions on them all the time.
See, part of the problem, though, is President Trump has a number of times here in the last couple of weeks especially said that he believes that it's the tariffs or sanctions that have brought all these other wars that he claims to have supported or ended. He says up to 8 of them now. He says, oh, yeah, sanctions are, and tariffs were a big, big part of that. That got them to do it. He actually goes into some detail and says, yeah, so because some of these parties, when I said we're going to have sanctions on you guys if you don't agree to it, and then they said, oh, well, we don't want that, so we'll agree to it. I don't know if he's just saying that for public consumption, or the worst scenario, he actually believes it. But if he does, then he may think that this is actually going to make a difference this time.
Well, as I said, this is not going to work with this war. I mean, there's no way that it will. I mean, putting economic pressure on the Russians is not going to make the Russians more accommodating. It is going to make them less accommodating. The Russians were already very upset by the fact that the Budapest summit was called off in the way that it was. Apparently, they say that it was President Trump who proposed it. Putin agreed to it. And then suddenly the Americans call it off and impose sanctions instead. That's made the Russians feel very angry. And I don't think that's going to change. And if you look at the, not just the rhetoric in Moscow, but the mood there, there's no doubt at all that it's hardened over the last week. And for the record, I follow very closely what is going on in the Russian economy. The ruble has barely shifted. The stock market is stable. Economic conditions seem to be as stable as always. There is little evidence that this is having any big panic effect in the financial markets. The Russians seem very confident that they can ride this out. And expectation suggests that they're right. Experience, rather, suggests that they're right.
So one of the second thing that Ambassador Whitaker said in that soundbite was that Trump has a lot of cards that he can play here. He has a lot of leverage. Do you see it that way?
No, I don't, actually. I think, on the contrary, that the more he plays this game, the less leverage he has. And of course, the risk is that as sanctions, more sanctions are applied, the less effective they become. And to the extent that there is any leverage, it diminishes. This is what has already been true with the sanctions that have been imposed already. If we'd spoken about sanctions 20 years ago, if you threatened the Russians with disconnection from the SWIFT payment system and told them that you were going to stop buying their gas. The Europeans were going to stop their buying their gas. That would have had a big impact in Moscow. People would have said, you know, this is serious. What are we going to do? After so many sanctions have already been applied and none of them has had the effect on the Russian economy, the people in the West and maybe some people in Russia expected, the effect of this diminishes with every time this card is played. I would add that I think it is all but inconceivable that China will stop buying Russian oil. China can easily, it consumes so much oil, it can replace any oil that India doesn't buy. I mean, it can. It has the capacity to do that. I've spoken to people in the oil industry. India almost certainly will continue to buy some oil from Russia. Probably they will work out schemes to continue to trade with each other, the oil trade with each other, because as we've discussed in previous programs, it is very much in India's advantage to do so. And Putin is due to visit India in a few weeks. He's going in December. India and Russia, by the way, have just concluded yesterday a deal whereby India will build Russian civil airliners in India. There's going to be a co-production agreement. India, for all sorts of reasons, will want to preserve its relationship with Russia because it is both in its economic and its strategic interests to do so. So there will be a hit in the sense that there will be less demand for Russian oil for a few months. Then everything will gradually rearrange itself. We will have all the usual workarounds developed. And eventually, things will go back to normal.
But the bottom line is, whatever pain it may have, it's not going to change any behavior by the Russian side or make them suddenly not care about core issues.
No, that's exactly the point. That's the key point.
So if we're going to look and say, all right, well, the diplomatic / sanctions economic front, that's not working very well, then what about on the battlefront? Because apparently, according to Ambassador Whitaker, in that same front, Russia's not succeeding there either.
President Trump has impressed on all of us, including our allies, is this war needs to end, and Russia needs to come to the table and resolve this dispute, resolve this war. They've made no progress in the last 3+ years of fighting. They still only control about 20% of Ukraine, and they're not, you know, going to accomplish much more, even if they continue to fight for years. And so the time is now to end this war.
So I guess we're just trying to do Russia a solid, trying to help you out here, man, because you haven't done anything in 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And even if you fight for years, knowing it's just not going to work, how do you think the Russians see that calculation?
Well, I think they're getting very frustrated. And if you go back to the telephone call that President Putin had with President Trump, one of the things that Putin tried to explain to President Trump over the course of that call is that the information that President Trump appears to be getting about the military situation is wrong. It's there, actually. It's unusually, surprisingly there in the Russian readout. Now, the Russians do not feel that the war is in stalemate. If you go to the Russian media, if you go to the Russian internet, if you go to Russian social media, the mood there is of growing self-confidence. They sense that the Ukrainians are weakening, that they're short of men, that they're short of machines, that the West is finding it increasingly difficult to replace the machines, that they've established dominance in the air with their major drone and missile offensive, that they're now breaking through in the last big line of defense in Donbass itself, and that they're advancing steadily towards the Dnieper in the west. So the mood in Russia is completely different from the one that Ambassador Whitaker imagines. And I don't mean here the Kremlin and the Russian government. I mean wider Russian public opinion. They sense that the war is going in their favor. It's been a long and hard war, but they believe that if not exactly on the brink of victory, at least they are making significant progress and victory starting to draw closer. However, victory in Russia is defined, about which, by the way, I should say, many people in Russia have different views.
You know, you talk about different interpretations of the exact same events.
Yeah.
Part of the other conversation that Putin had with some of his troops, as well as some of his generals here in the last couple of days, was that there are two areas, one in Kupiansk in the north on the Eastern Front and another one in Pokrovsk, that he says, you know what, we have a lot of their troops surrounded. He got a briefing from his commanders the other day, and that was actually mentioned at a previous episode.
In two locations, in Kupiansk and Krasnoyarsk, the enemy has been encircled. Incidentally, I discussed this issue with the commanders of the relevant groups. They wouldn't object, Rinovich, to allowing media representatives, foreign journalists, and, well, Ukrainian journalists, into the enemy encirclement zones so that they could enter and see with their own eyes what's happening, and verify the state of the encircled troops.
For anybody who's made aware, the Russian version of the city is called Krasnoyarsk, which we call Pokrovsk here. So he's talking about Pokrovsk and Kupiansk. And there's lots of information out there that a lot of people on the Ukraine and the Western side are saying they're not surrounded. That's completely untrue. And so Putin seems to be putting his money where his mouth is and says, how about you guys send your journalists out here? We'll have a ceasefire, a local ceasefire in the areas, and you can come in and see for yourself and figure out what you're going to do. I have seen earlier today, and by the way, I'm going to do a whole show on this for our viewers here on this tactical situation where they are, the Pokrovsk especially is near collapse, and along with Kupiansk, there's serious problems going on up there. And from a number of different sources, I'm going to be talking about that today. But one of the ones that I'm not referring to there, but will hear, is that on the Ukraine Telegram channels, there is significant alarm in the headquarters in Kiev, that they are greatly worried that they have to start withdrawing their troops really fast, or they could literally lose 7,000 to 10,000 of them that they could get cut off there. So it appears to be taken pretty seriously in the Ukraine command center. You've seen with whether it's Bakhmut or some of these other cities that they've had over the course of this war, that they almost never withdraw their troops until it's too late, and then they end up getting destroyed in place. The fact that they're talking about it right now, that they may have to conduct, and we're talking within the next 24, 48 hours, a major withdrawal from the area, or they could lose even more of their troops. How do you see that?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I'm going to watch your program, by the way, with great interest and anticipation. But everything that you have said is borne out by what I myself have been seeing. You're absolutely correct. If you look at the Ukrainian Telegram channels and you look at the Russian ones, they're all telling the same story. And it is the one that Putin is setting out in his comments to the soldiers, which is in both Pokrovsk and in Kupiansk, the Russians have significant Ukrainian forces surrounded. Now, I don't know how many exactly. Some people in Russia said 10,000 men altogether in the two places. Others put it rather less than that. I'm not going to try and guess, but undoubtedly an encirclement is taking place, and both of these two towns are going to fall. I think that people who think otherwise are wrong. And I think, by the way, something else. In the West, people take far too much of their information, I think, from the official Ukrainian government. And I'm not going to be very critical here, by the way. War is, something where, you have to sometimes say things that are less than the truth to others in order to keep them on side and things like that. But you should never assume that what the Ukrainians are telling you is completely true, just as you should never assume that what the Russians are telling you is necessarily true. But if you go to the medias, the social medias of these countries, then you get a very different impression of the state of the war. And this time, social media on the Russian side is confident. Social media on the Ukrainian side is panicking. And they're getting their information from their friends in the army, from their contacts in the Ukrainian military, from people like that who are in a position to know.
And, you know, you can add to that from the West, Julian Rupka, which I know you and I have mentioned several times, is one of the more accurate and definitely pro-Ukraine. You see, he actually has the Ukraine flag in his name there. But he says, with Pokrovsk and now Mirgorod, which is the sister city of the Pokrovsk pocket, heavily occupied by Russian forces and more logistic routes under Russian infantry control, with increasing risk of major encirclement, the Ukrainian military leadership continues to deny the severity of the situation. No words, he says right there. So that's got to tell you something. Who's somebody who's definitely for the Ukraine side himself is calling out this unwillingness to talk publicly, officially, about what's actually going on there, because that doesn't help anyone. That doesn't help anyone on the Ukraine side to continue to pretend like things are otherwise, whether that's the Ukraine side or whether it's the U.S. ambassador who's like said, yeah, they haven't done anything. And you may recall, I think it was last month, where Emmanuel Macron said he also mocked the Russians that they hadn't gained in the last 2 years any more than one additional percent. Like, that, it's no big deal. And actually, Donald Tusk actually said in the last 24 hours, after a conversation with Zelensky, he goes, don't worry about it. Ukraine can keep fighting for years, 2 or 3 years in the future. So we just need to keep giving them more ammunition and weapons and everything will be fine. Everything won't be fine. And I'm not convinced. As a matter of fact, it's actually the pull up a comment from one of your countrymen there at the Times in London, where Roger Boyce says, hey, I'm not even sure they're still going to be there in the spring. Yeah. Kiev might not even last until the spring. How significant is this for another quite very pro-Ukrainian person now in the UK media here for him to say this?
Well, can I first of all say, Julian Röpke, with whom I disagree about many things, about many facts about the war, is nonetheless, in my opinion, an outstanding war correspondent. I mean, he has generally reported things as they are. If he is saying that the situation in Pokrovsk is at close to encirclement, then you can say definitely that we are looking at a military crisis. Roger Boyce is the foreign news editor of the London Times. He is one of the most established figures in British journalism. He is a strong supporter of Ukraine, somebody who is extremely critical of the Putin government, that's putting it mildly, and somebody who is extremely well connected in British government circles and undoubtedly receives talks to people in the British political and military establishment who know about the true situation on the battlefronts. If Roger Boyce is saying that Kiev might not survive until the spring, that is something you should take extremely seriously. And on these points, I have to say, I believe Julian Röpke, I believe Roger Boyce, above Ambassador Whitaker, and certainly above people like Donald Tusk and people like that. They know, and I am sure that they are right, and they have no reason at all to deceive.
For those who may not be aware, let me just real quick, I'm going to run to the map right here, because the claim that the Ukrainians are surrounded here, some people look at the map and they go, well, they're not surrounded. There's all this area right here. It's wide open. This gray thatched area right here, or this gray band that's on the map here, that's not a physical barrier, but what that shows is where the Russians have fire control, because they're in Rodinska up here in the north. And then in the city of Pokrovsk itself, I mean, they continue to take more and more territory. More than half of the city itself is gone. This is Mirnokrad, the other area that was mentioned on one of those videos we just showed you. It's the sister city here. Russia is now moving into the southern part of that, and then now even into the northern part. So they're closing in here. This is where a lot of the Ukraine troops are, all in this area they're defending right now. But if Russia has under fire control the only routes coming in or out, then that means it's going to be extremely difficult just to keep them supplied with more ammunition, weapons, food, fuel, etc. And if Russia is able to move in to close this physically off, then they don't even have to fight to take all of these towns and or villages and you know, some of these smaller ones, the buildings, etc. So because there are still some pretty strong defensive positions in here. But if Russia closes these off, they don't need to take this, because then they can literally starve them out and just wait them to come out and they'll have the whole thing. So that's why this is in a really dangerous situation. And, you know, Alexander, when you get into this situation and you look at the situation with these nuclear weapons that have been demonstrated by the Russian side, when you see the economic situation here, not what Ambassador Whitaker is hoping for, but the reality that you talked about here, and then you look at the tactical situation, everything screams that there is nothing to gain for the entire Western world, to include Ukraine, to continue this war any further. Why wait until they collapse here in this pocket? Why wait until the Kiev itself falls, because they don't have the military forces, if Boyce is correct in this? Why try to find that out when there's no rational path to reverse any of these things and still keep going with the war? What is the logic here?
Well, I don't fully understand the logic myself, because I'm not a military person. I'm not able to explain things tactically in the way that you've just done about Pokrovsk. But to me, it's been perfectly obvious for a long time, basically since very early on in the war, that we were going to arrive at this point eventually. Because I go back to an article that I remember reading that you wrote right at the start of the conflict, which is that will on both sides to keep fighting appears to be equal. In such a situation, it is the side with the greater resources that is going to win in the end, all other things being equal. And the side with the greater resources by far here is the Russians. So, yes, we have been able to balance out some of that resource gap up to a certain point ourselves by lending supplies, giving supplies to Ukraine. But we've never been able to do it enough to change that calculus that you discussed 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So this is what people need to understand. Now, I don't really fully understand all of the thinking. I've explained, we've discussed in previous programs, that some people in Europe want the war to go on because they're worried that the United States might leave. I think that a military defeat in the Ukraine is much more likely in the end to cause the United States to leave than a negotiated resolution would. Anyway, I still don't understand that thinking, though I happen to know that it exists. And it is very prevalent in European capitals.
If you're not an expert in the military stuff, that's fair enough. But you are a lot more knowledgeable than I am, I think, in the political stuff, especially within Europe. So let's just look at Ursula von der Leyen, Mark Rutte, Kaja Kallas, etc., and especially Keir Starmer and Friedrich Merz and Emmanuel Macron. That group right there, they are political animals. They love to live to fight another day politically. They don't want to lose. They don't want to have their support cut, etc. It seems to me, from a political perspective, if you can honestly, behind the scenes, away from the cameras, recognizing the calculus that you just very articulately laid out about if the political will is the same, then all other things being equal, it's the side that has the greater inputs that's going to win. Now it's starting to really play out. So if they are political animals and they don't want to lose, doesn't it seem like that at some point they're going to have to change course, maybe like Bose did there a second ago? Otherwise, they're going to be holding a losing position. And if the expected happens and the military defeat is inflicted, they'll lose politically as well. How does that work out for them?
Well, I think actually you might have put your finger on the problem, because I think these people are now so deeply committed to this. They have spoken so strongly about the necessity to defeat Russia and Ukraine, and they've used that word. I mean, they've actually talked about defeating Russia in Ukraine, that I think they probably fear that if they started to negotiate with the Russians in a way that basically conceded anything that might look like a Russian victory, it would be politically catastrophic for them. Bear in mind that in Europe, we have suffered severely as a result of this war. I mean, we talk about sanctions against Russia, but we see deindustrialization in Germany, economic stagnation in Britain, in France, across Europe. And all of that, as everybody basically knows, is linked to the war and to the economic war that is being fought alongside it. So to come round and tell people in Europe, we did all of this, we spent all that money, we gave all that money to Ukraine, we gave them all our weapons, we engineered deindustrialization in Europe, and actually we have to negotiate and do a deal after all. I think for people like all of the people that you mentioned, that is just more than they can bring themselves to do. So what they're doing instead is hoping that this will go on, and that eventually something somewhere will change or turn. Maybe the latest sanctions will somehow do the trick, or maybe Mr. Putin will fall under a bus, or something will happen. You know, live day by day and hope that something will turn up.
That's, you know what? That is at least plausible. We interviewed a Ukrainian journalist some months back during the summer, and he was from the, I believe it was the Kiev Independent, so not the Kiev Post, which is kind of more pro government. This one was at least more quasi independent, and they were willing to say some things that were, you know, not popular. And I pressed the guy on it once, and I said, kind of like that, I said, how can, you know, you continue to justify going on and supporting the war when all of these inputs are the way they are? And he said something that really I had no comeback to, because he said, basically, we're hoping for a miracle. We just, you know, if we can just keep fighting today, then maybe tomorrow a miracle. I mean, he actually said that. Now, for the country who's fighting, I think it's a terrible way to conduct combat, but at least I can understand it. Yeah. But I can understand it less from the European perspective, hoping for a miracle, because it's just not going to come. And for them to have the same mentality, not under fire, and with their cities not being burned, and the continuing to go down this path with the Russians now introducing new, you know, nuclear weapons, that seems to be counterproductive. But I think maybe that's the best explanation. I don't think I can come up with a better one.
Well, I think ultimately, as I said, there's no rational explanation to this. But as I said, we have this expression in England, Micawberism, which is what it is. Live from day to day and hope that something will turn up. Now, the problem is, it is also a profoundly cynical and inhumane approach. Because
yes,
Mr. Tusk can talk wonderfully, you know, bravely about Ukraine fighting on for 3 years. What will Ukraine look like in 3 years if that were, in fact, to happen? I mean, think of the number of people who that kind of language, well, I don't say it condemns them to death, but it sets up the situation which might lead them to being killed. So I think this is a terrible way to think, and it's a terrible way to approach these problems. But it does seem to these political leaders we have in Europe, who I ought to say, as a group of people, are the least impressive political leaders Europe has produced in my lifetime, by far.
Wow.
To them, it looks as if, you know, this is the kind of outlook that they have. They don't want to admit that it's all failed. They don't want to face their own people and explain that it was all terrible, went terribly wrong. So they just keep going.
And yeah, I can understand their reluctance and their wanting to avoid that outcome. But just in the last few minutes that we have here, what would you project, given your history and your knowledge about European affairs, if the expected happens and the predictable occurs and there is eventually a collapse of the Ukrainian armed forces and they just lose the war? If these leaders we just mentioned don't want to have that hard conversation by choice now, what is going to happen when the choice is taken out of their hands? What will happen in their political world?
Well, I mean, I think at that point, perhaps we could start looking at a massive political change in Europe. I mean, one of the things to say is that all of these leaders are, without exception now, extremely unpopular in Britain, in Germany, in France, even in Italy, which is less involved in the war anyway. And even in Poland, which is very involved in the war, but which has its own historical grievances, legitimate historical grievances against Russia. The mood is souring, and you can see political forces increasingly growing stronger that are challenging and disagreeing with this whole policy. Now, the trouble with those forces is that some of them don't look particularly convincing or credible as governments. And what they would represent if they ever came to power would be such an enormous break with what has existed up to now in Europe that, I mean, a political revolution might not be too strong a word to describe what might come.
Wow, that's saying quite a bit.
Can I just say, at the moment, at the present moment in time, Reform UK, which is the insurgent party, is polling more than the Labour and Conservative parties, the parties that have dominated British politics for over 100 years. It's polling more than the two of them put together. So does start to look a bit like a political revolution coming.
It does, and we'll certainly keep a close eye on that one there. So appreciate you bringing that, highlighting it to our viewers here. That's interesting and something we'll be keeping a watch on. And I would wager that there's probably similar dynamics in both France and Germany.
Yeah.
We'll see how it works out there. But listen, I appreciate you coming on today and providing us such clarity on this. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we need to be concerned about. And the hope is always that the people can, with their voices, by whatever means that are going on here with politically or with, you know, sending out notices like this, or even showing up and protesting here and there, is that we still have the final word here. So we're not without agency or without power, and we're very hopeful that that happens, because anything that can get this war over with will do two things. It will stop the pointless slaughter of people in Ukraine, and God help us all, it may also prevent this from escalating beyond the borders of Ukraine, which would be catastrophic for mankind. And that's why we appreciate you coming on so much, bringing sanity into an otherwise crazy conversation.
Thank you very much, Daniel. And I must say, it's always a pleasure to come onto these programs. And I'm very, very much looking forward to your analysis of the battle that's playing out at the moment in Ukraine. I go to you for military analysis all the time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And we appreciate
And consistently right as well. Going all the way back, all those years, first article appeared, I've never forgotten it.
Well, thank you very much. And by the way, for those of you who just can't get enough of Alexander, you can go to his channel right there at the Duran. You can see the address right there. And so you don't have to wait another day. You see a lot of great titles just sitting right there. We will take a look at that soon. Thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate you guys. And I will see you in about 30 minutes or 40 minutes from now on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. See you then.